says the city and Blackhawks are working to finalize the parade route. They plan to release the route tomorrow. City officials encourage fans to take public transportation, not bring restricted items, and take precautions for warm weather. Other sports news, relief pitcher Carlos Marmol wasn't the only Chicago Cubs player who was cut yesterday. The Cubs also released infielder Ian Stewart, who had been at AAA Iowa and was suspended for 2 weeks ago for criticizing the organization on Twitter. The Cubs continue their series in Milwaukee tonight. Elsewhere in the schedule, the Cardinals are in Houston and the White Sox take on the Mets again in interleague play. I'm Jeff Bossert, Illinois Public Media News.
At Illinois Public Media, we are getting really close to closing out our fiscal year and meeting our fundraising goal. With your help, we will finish strong. Make your contribution today by calling 217-244-9455 or donate online at willpledge.org. Every contribution makes a real difference. Don't wait. Support your local public media station right now. Thank you.
You're listening to WYLL. Let's take a look at your Champaign-Urbana weather for the rest of today. A flash flood watch remains in effect through this evening for Champaign County and quite a few surrounding counties, portions of central Illinois today, including DeWitt, Macon, McLean, Moultrie, and Piatt. We are seeing about 2 to 4 inches of rain last night, especially near Bloomington and southeast through Champaign and Tuscola. And we're expecting about another inch today or early this evening with some locally higher totals as well in places that are going to be getting heavier rainstorms. This means that flash flooding is likely, and as the rain will be coming down torrentially at times this evening. So be on warning for that, and please continue to check weather updates throughout the afternoon. Taking a look at Champaign specifically, we're expecting showers and thunderstorms, about a 70% chance of rain by late afternoon with a high of 85. Tonight, mostly cloudy, 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms and a low of 68. By tomorrow, less of a chance of rain, about a 20% chance of showers in the afternoon and a high of 84. By Friday, mostly sunny with a high of 84. Then into the weekend, we are seeing about a 50% chance of rain on Saturday and Sunday. Let's take a look at some temperatures around the state right now. It is largely overcast or raining at the moment. In Chicago at O'Hare Airport, it's cloudy and 71. In Galesburg, mostly sunny and 80 right now. Decatur, it's cloudy and 72. Peoria, partly sunny and 80 degrees at the moment. In Springfield, we are seeing some light drizzle and 72 degrees. In Champaign and Mattoon, thunderstorm conditions and 76 degrees. It's 75 at Friends Plaza in Urbana outside of our studios. And we will keep you posted on weather updates throughout the day here on WILL.
Programs on WILL are made possible by The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377. Open 7 days a week for lunch and dinner.
You're listening to WILL. The dream of damming the Mississippi River between Hamilton and Keokuk became a reality in 1910. The funding had been secured so work could get underway. In part two of a series called Damming the Mighty Mississippi, Illinois Public Radio's Jason Parrott looks at how the dam was actually built.
Engineer Hugh Cooper seemed to understand the significance of this project. He had writers sending articles to magazines and newspapers throughout the country, and he hired a local photographer to document the entire construction process.
And he started January 8th of 1910. He got a picture of 10 men with shovels digging a trench, and that was what they started.
That's Mike Foley with the planning committee for the 100th anniversary celebration.
They didn't have any kind of machinery at all. So what they brought in next were horses and mules with kind of a very large scoop shovel. They would scoop the dirt away. What they were trying to do was to get down to raw rock.
The dam's foundation was eventually anchored to the exposed rock. Foley says year one was devoted to site preparation, so workers had everything necessary to build the dam, including rock crushers, cement mixers, and bunkhouses. He says the first half of 1911 was also spent on dry land, building one-third of the dam. The river was not as wide or deep as it is today, so the work took place in a cornfield. Everything changed later that year as they reached the shoreline of the Mississippi River. Foley says crews built and installed large wooden cofferdams, which were filled with rock to hold back the Mississippi River while they worked.
And then they would pump out the water, and once they'd gotten it dry, then they could dig down until they got the rock to the exact place, many times having to drill holes and put dynamite in and blow it up until they had it to the level that they wanted so they could pour foundations.
Foley says Cooper's workers could build the cofferdams quickly, as most of them worked with him at Niagara Falls.
One of our most exciting pictures that we have in the exhibit is men working with water rushing underneath their feet, and they're trying to get the last of the cribs in place.
There were definitely challenges along the way, including severe flooding in 1912. Foley says based on the photographs he has reviewed, it appears the river reached the same level in 1912 as it did during the record-setting flood of 1993.
They really thought they were going to lose the cofferdam, and they had put some dynamite in place. They were going to purposely blow up a small section, so therefore they wouldn't lose the whole cofferdam.
Foley says there was even one night where hundreds of men raced from the bunkhouses to the construction site with shovels and sandbags to protect the cofferdams. He says had they been lost, it could have taken another year for construction to be completed. There was also tragedy along the way, as several dozen workers died as a result of accidents occurring during construction. Despite that, work continued until 1913, when the dam was completed. Foley says one of the ways Cooper was able to bring the project in on time and under budget was because of the innovations he implemented. One would think trial and error would have been heavily involved.
Except that it was very cemented in Cooper. That's why he was such a genius. He could picture that this is how it had to be built. So there wasn't very much trial and error, because he didn't have time for that.
Foley points to the use of the largest cranes in the world at the time to pour concrete, and the fact that Cooper used an on-time delivery method to save storage space. He also believes Cooper created a new tool for use in building the cofferdams.
In all the other pictures, there was a crew of sledgehammers driving these rods down in. When I get down to the last picture of the last crib, there's no sledgehammers. And I looked around, and I see this big thing on the lane there, and I believe that was the first jackhammer.
All of these firsts led to the first dam being built across the Mississippi River. Part 3 of Damming the Mighty Mississippi will look at how the dam and the nearby power plant, which Cooper also built, operate on a daily basis. I'm Jason Parrott.
And you're listening to WILL. Wednesday marks the 100th anniversary of a state law that made Illinois one of the most progressive states in granting voting rights to women. On June 26, 1913, Governor Edward Dunn signed a bill which gave Illinois women the right to vote in local elections and for the presidency. Women in the state were still barred from voting for the state and legislative and congressional races, but it was still seen as a big step forward. Until that time, only a few states had let women vote for president, and those were mostly in the West. Western Illinois University history professor Ginny Boynton said Illinois' decision to open presidential voting to women was a pretty big deal.
Our state was the most populous state in which women got presidential voting rights at that point, the only state east of the Mississippi, east of Kansas, in fact, where women had presidential voting rights. So it was seen as a mainstream place for it to happen, as opposed to out there in the Wild West.
That's Professor Boynton appearing on yesterday's episode of WILL's show Focus. You can hear the full program at will.illinois.edu/focus. Well, this week is a big one for anniversaries in women's suffrage. It's also the 125th anniversary of the National Council of Women of the United States, which is more commonly known as the Women's Suffrage Party. No one knew that there was a safe that was actually... There was, in fact, a safe that was put together at the first Women's Suffrage Party, and it has just been opened. NPR's Margot Adler has the story of what's inside.
On the website of the University of Rochester's Susan B. Anthony Center, people have been speculating all week about what might be in the safe. Will we find lists of secret members, asked one person, organizing strategies and protest plans? Perhaps the original copy of the 19th Amendment, giving women the right to vote? Perhaps love letters? Perhaps photographs? Perhaps nothing, someone else said. And that's exactly what the safe cracker, Elad Israeli, said. Most times when he opens safes, there's not much.
You know, rubber bands, paper clips, pens.
Israeli started to work the combination lock while people crowded into a tiny room.
I don't want to sound rude, but I really need quiet to be able to concentrate.
He said it would take anywhere from 20 minutes to an hour as he manipulated the combination lock back and forth, occasionally making notes on a pad, and then suddenly it was done.
I can open it now.
Just pull on the handle.
screw on the handle.
Oh, there's some stuff in it.
And there is stuff in there. A lot of stuff.
A lot of stuff in here.
First, there was a change purse filled with coins from France, Mexico, various countries. There was a box with a Smithsonian replica of the gavel originally used by Susan B. Anthony and an envelope that revealed the safe had been opened within the last 14 years. I said to Catherine Cerulli, the director of the Susan B. Anthony Center at the University of Rochester, some of this stuff is modern.
Yes, and I think, in fact, when you look at the stamp on that envelope, it's 1999.
Yeah. So someone got in.
Someone's been in.
There were medals, a silver brooch, a wooden stamp, a corporate seal, a paper of incorporation dating back to 1931, and many other documents.
Federal tax exemption, it looks like 1957. IRS letter, 1940.
They didn't open the documents and letters because archivists suggested they handle them with care, and many may later be digitized. Perhaps the most lovely items were six small panels, replicas of huge wall murals of women that were commissioned for the Chicago World's Fair in 1933. We look at one of the panels. Catherine Cerulli points out that one woman is clearly a Red Cross worker.
Historical pictures of women, women caring for others. Perhaps these are historical figures.
Why was the safe not open for a long time? Mary Singletary, the president of the National Council of Women of the United States, said the hundreds of dollars needed to hire a locksmith was just too much for an organization struggling to survive with multiple projects about women and girls.
I had to make a choice of raising money for my program or raising money to pay this gentleman.
She chose the programs until the University of Rochester joined the effort. One thing they found was a candy box filled with keys, one going to a storage room in the basement. So who knows? There may be more discoveries. Margo Adler, NPR News, New York.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Trophy Time in Champaign. Trophy Time features a Go Green catalog with a variety of items, organic, recycled, or biodegradable, like pet accessories, travel mugs, and water bottles. Information on their Go Green catalog can be found at trophytime.com. They're more than just trophies.
Voting rights, affirmative action, same-sex marriage, workplace discrimination. It's a big week at the U.S. Supreme Court. Join Linda Wertheimer, along with NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, for a recap and in-depth analysis of all the major rulings. It's special programming from NPR News.
Tonight at 7 on AM 580.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 26th of June, 2013. It's the birthday of novelist Pearl S. Buck, born in Hillsboro, West Virginia. Her parents were Presbyterian ministers in China, and Buck was born while they were on vacation in the United States. When she was 3 months old, her parents took her back to China, where they had been, and she learned to speak Chinese before she learned to speak English. She fled China after civil war erupted and began writing a novel on the ship to America called East Wind, West Wind. The following year, she published The Good Earth, about a Chinese peasant who becomes a wealthy landowner. At the time, Westerners saw China as one of the most exotic places on earth. Pearl Buck was the first writer to portray the lives of ordinary Chinese people for a Western audience. The novel won a Pulitzer Prize and became an international bestseller. It's the birthday of the blues musician Big Bill Brunsey, born in Scott, Mississippi in 1898, one of 17 children of parents born into slavery. When he was a young boy, his uncle made him a fiddle from a cigar box and taught him how to play. He later moved to Chicago, learned to play the guitar and sing the blues. He began making recordings and soon became one of the most popular blues singers in the country. He sang at Carnegie Hall. But by the late 40s, the blues began to change with Muddy Waters' electric guitar sound and style. By 1950, Brunsey was working as a janitor at Iowa State University when Studs Terkel rediscovered him and had him on his program as a frequent guest. Eric Clapton later credited Brunsey as one of his strongest influences. And it's the birthday of the poet and memoirist Laurie Lee, born in Stroud, Gloucestershire, England, in 1914. He was the 11th of 12 children, grew up in a tiny English village where everyone lived in crumbling houses with huge families and no electricity or running water. He said, "We lived at the mercy of the seasons, saw little of the outside world, cooked on wood fires, and went to bed by candlelight. I belonged to a kind of tribal community which had lasted for 1,000 years, but which since has died out, and I saw the last of it." When he was 15, Laurie Lee dropped out of high school. After working as an errand boy, he walked to London, which took him about a month, sleeping in fields and making money during the day playing his violin. Then later he took off to Spain, where he witnessed the Spanish Civil War. He published many books of poetry during the 1940s without much success, but then he began to write his memoirs, for which he is best remembered. Near the end of his